Tonight, Debbie S. comes. She claims the Wednesday 8 o'clock NAVA as her home group, and she is anxious to get up here.
I am.
Get out of the way quick. There you go.
Oh, thank you.
Welcome, Debbie.
Glad you weren't done. Hi. I'm Debbie. I'm an alcoholic. Yeah. Well, it's easy to know fear. Come up here. Try this. I brought all these books with me because I thought that they would look good. So I'm going to put them over here. That's not true. I've told my story before, and I tend to get too involved in what it was like because it was 30 years, and so I want to just be a little more careful tonight to say in the solution. So I'd like to start, if you would indulge me, with a little piece of family history, because apparently my sister and I are the only addicts and alcoholics ever in the family. But my mother's father was a bigamist. That means he was married to another woman at the same time he was married to my grandmother. She was forced into this marriage, an arranged marriage, because she was the daughter of an Orthodox rabbi. And her two younger sisters wanted to get married, so they forced her into this marriage anyway. Because he was a bigamist, eventually she found out, and the marriage was dissolved. So I never knew this man. I only knew his name was Barney, and he was stocky and redhead and freckles and a boxer. But given the fact that he had such an addiction to maybe women that he couldn't stay married to one, maybe there were other addictions that we didn't know about. I just wanted to throw that in, because that also gives you an idea of the extreme dysfunction that followed that in my family. Maybe it gives you a little idea. Anyway, when I was 7, my mother left my father and married another man immediately. Like the same day, we went and moved in with this other guy. And I guess I became this perfect child. I mean, I was perfect. My hair was perfect. I dressed perfectly. I cooked. I cleaned. I sewed. I took care of my sisters. And in retrospect, I thought my father would come back, but he never did. Oh, I thought he might, but by the time I was 14, I guess I figured I was through being good, because that's when I was introduced to beer. So I was starting high school. I was kind of a little dork up until then. I was a skinny little, kind of ugly, unpopular, dorky kid who just took care of her sisters. And I never played. All I did was, you know, knit, sew, clean, cook. It's really a dork. But when I went to high school, and nobody, and boys didn't like me, when they played spin the bottle and got me, they spun again, and I'm not kidding. Because I was a really slow developer, really slow. I was like a little boy. But anyway, that's a true story. So then I get to high school, and I was introduced to shooting beer. So what I remember is, I think you shake the beer, and then you put a little hole in the bottom with one of those church key things, and then you lift the top, and it shoots down your throat. Well, that was my first drink, and it was wonderful. And I remember that night, we were outside the high school, we were all excited to start going there, and we decided we needed to drink and become cool. And this was, you know, in the 70s, yeah. And Vietnam was going on, and we all kind of wanted to be cool, like all the Boston University kids. This is in Boston. So that just sort of went, that was the beginning of my no longer being a straight-A student, no longer coming home and taking care of my sisters. I had become a complete brat. Now my mother will tell you, if anybody would listen, how I destroyed her life. And still now, after 8 years sober, I destroyed her life. But it's okay, because I kind of did. After that, I remember always being drunk in school, or we did other things in school at that time, other forms of alcohol. And I guess you can use your imagination. And, of course, marijuana and There were little pills in those days called Crossroads that helped you get to school because they were speed. And so that was happening all the time. My mother's husband was a recovering heroin addict, her second husband. And he was out of his mind. Out of his mind. He knew, he could tell something was wrong, but thank God he was out of the house by the time I was 15, because he was really bad news. Really bad news. Emotionally, physically, and verbally abusive to my sisters and me and my mother and our dogs. And I won't go into that. But he was gone, and then there was some freedom there because he wasn't there to see what I was doing. And my mother was never home because she worked three jobs. So I was constantly gone, constantly high. In high school, I had this boyfriend, my first boyfriend, Anthony Eos. He was the pot dealer in the school. And he was my very first boyfriend, and so I was like really cool because that was my boyfriend. And of course, I smoked pot in my house at night by myself, and while listening to Neil Young, I really thought I was the hippie. And then, of course, it became worse. But he got worse than any of us, and he ended up at a young age in a treatment center. But that was the beginning of my attraction to boys and men who either were alcoholics or drug addicts, or were always getting sent up the river. That's what they used to say, I'm getting sent up tomorrow. And they would be gone, and you wouldn't see them for a long time. But I guess being with people like that, I don't know, I felt loved. I don't know, I felt comfortable. It was a comfortable thing to be with other people who were messed up, so I couldn't be judged, maybe. One of the most important things I remember was getting people to buy us alcohol. Going up to the liquor stores and standing on the corners in the middle of winter with our mittens and our cigarettes and getting an adult to go into the liquor store and buy a case of Schlitz. Does anyone remember Schlitz? I don't even know if it's around. Anyway, one time we finally got this case of Schlitz. There were like four girls and we're going to drink the whole case and we're lugging it into the park because we don't have a car. And this cop pulls over. This is a true story. And he looks at the case of Schlitz and he says, you couldn't get by, he takes the Schlitz, puts in his car and drives off. And I was shocked, going, he's going to drink that beer. And so, looking at it now, of course he was drinking the beer. But that's what we did, we spent our nights drinking. When I was about 16 or 17, my mother met her third husband. And I used to steal her car at night and go into the combat zone. And if you don't know what the combat zone is, it was a really bad place in Boston that they've now cleaned up. It was mostly strip clubs, gay bars, things that now you think they're normal, but in those days you had to go into the combat zone. And 16 years old, steal my mother's car, leave at 1 in the morning and go to the combat zone with my best friend Michael, who was the only gay person that I ever knew, and we would go to the gay bar and dance and drink and get really drunk, and most of the time I would pass out on the floor from drinking. And I don't know how I drove home. But one night I drove home, and my mother and her boyfriend, her husband-to-be, were just sitting. It was 4 in the morning. They were waiting for me. And so I got into a lot of trouble. But that didn't stop me, because another time I took her car, and I drove it into a tree. I had 5 people in the car. We were all taking something called Cephenols. Let's just say little red forms of alcohol, and literally head on into a tree. And so I ruined my mother's car so many times she finally gave it to me, and I drove that car. It was a Delta 88 Oldsmobile. It was gold with a black convertible top, and we used to have 4 girls in the back and 4 girls up on the top. It was so much fun. Okay, so how am I doing? Okay, so that's high school. And then one night I came home and I decided that I wanted my new boyfriend, Frankie. he was going to sleep over. He's going to sleep over because I'm telling you he's going to sleep over. I was obnoxious. And my mother's, at the time, boyfriend, husband, was like this kind of short little Jewish guy, and he rolled up his sleeves and he's trying to stick up for my mother, and he said, you're not going to sleep over here. It was horrible. Anyway, my little sister came along and decided that she would hit me over the head with this They went to Aruba, and they got back these exotic things, like fruits that were hard as a rock, and she hit me over the head with it and knocked me out. And so that's how that evening was settled. Frankie left, and I was knocked out. So my mother then sent me to a psychiatrist, which you would think she would have thought of that before, but okay. So she said, you need to go to the psychiatrist. At that time, we discovered quasars. Anyway, those things were horrendous. I mean, you drink and do those things, and, you know, forget it. You don't know who you're with. You don't know. You black out every minute. You lose things. They're bad. So she said, you're going to go to the psychiatrist. And so I got on my bicycle, because that's where I got everywhere, and I drove down Commonwealth Avenue on my bike. It was near Tufts University. And I go into the office of the psychiatrist, and high as a kite on everything, and I sit down, and a few minutes later, I don't remember, but the psychiatrist called my mother, and he said, I can't help you. Your daughter just tried to seduce me. I was only 16 years old, but that's what that stuff used to do. So then she called my biological father and said, would you take her? And, of course, he wouldn't take me. So I just left, and I continued my little career. I went to Maine, Old Orchard Beach. It was a little party town in southern Maine, and I became a cocktail waitress. Actually, before that, I lived up there before that, too, actually, when I was 17 in the summer. And I have to go back a little bit because I discovered Janis Joplin at my first boyfriend Anthony's sister's wedding. Her name was Gay. And she was beautiful. And she got up with a microphone like this without any music, and she sang a Janis Joplin song called Oh Lord, Won't You Buy Me a Mercedes-Benz? And I fell in love with her and Janis Joplin. And I was actually going to sing it, but I'm too nervous. So you've been spared. So I really thought Janis Joplin was the coolest thing ever, and she drank Southern Comfort all the time. So I was 17, and I decided I wanted to drink a fifth of Southern Comfort by myself. And I did. I might have been 16. It was up in Maine. Anyway, drank the whole thing with this girl that I met, that she was a lifeguard, and she was older than me, and she was this big girl, and she could drink a fifth, so I thought I could do it too. And that was my, well, not my first blackout, but one of the major blackouts I had. And this girl, we all lived in a rooming house called Tide Rock House. It was a bunch of girls living there. And one of the girls was coming home from downtown drinking, and she walked down the street, and she saw a dog. A dog in the middle of the street, and she went over to pick it up, and it was me. In a pile, sleeping on the street. So, I'll stop the teenage years there. I went on to college, and it just was the same stuff. I went to, well, it took me 4.5 years. That's not so bad. But I changed majors and colleges several times. I did nothing but party for 4.5 years. But I also want to say that every boyfriend I had was an alcoholic. And looking back on it, I realized that it was because they all drank more than me. And so I felt like I wasn't so bad because they were like major, wake up in the morning, which I eventually became, but I wasn't that bad. It never occurred to me I even had a problem. You growing up in the 60s and 70s, everyone does it. Everyone's doing. Everyone's high. Everyone's drinking. Everyone's, you know, what everyone was doing then. So college came and went. I was really, I don't know what to say. I was really good at in school, even though I didn't, like I skipped a lot of classes, but I did all right. Like I still have nightmares about missing a class. Like I'll have a nightmare now, all this time later, that I had a class that I skipped for months and didn't know it. And I still wake up and go, oh, God, I had a class and I didn't know about it. And then I realized it was a dream. Like, I was so bad at not going to my classes. So, but I did get a really good job in Manhattan. My mother had remarried and moved to New York. And so I went there and got a job. In the first 2 weeks living at home, my mother's husband's daughter came home, and she was a spoiled little Jewish rich kid brat. And I grew up on welfare, believe it or not, because my mother was alone. But this girl was obnoxious. And I went up to her and said something horrible in front of my mother's husband, and they threw me out. So I met my first husband, because he owned the house, and said, would you like to move in with me? And I said, yeah. And we got married, and he introduced me to a very bad drug. And I spent a few years, a couple years, married to him and doing bad things, and had a nervous breakdown as a result of that. But I was still really good at my job, although every day when I went out to lunch, I was a buyer at a publishing company, and so I got a lot of perks, and one of those perks was always going out to expensive restaurants, and I always drank my lunch. So I was drunk all the time, and when I left work, I would go into Penn Station in New York and go into the bars and get really drunk. But then I would go on to the Long Island Railroad drinking car. They had drinking cars and smoking cars, and I would drink all the way home. So I was drinking a lot. Still, I didn't think I had a problem. Okay, I'm going to fast forward to got married to my second husband, had my children. He was an alcoholic. We drank all the time. And that became a verbal and physically abusive relationship. And so I left when I was 41. And when I left there, I felt like now I'm really going to drink. And I used to leave my children alone or leave them alone for a day and a half with a 16-year-old babysitter, and they were only 3 or 4 and 3 and 6 or 4 and 8, that kind of thing. And the years of doing that took its toll on my relationship with my kids. And then I met the one person who really was kind of my downfall. And his name was Jimmy. And I read something in the big book earlier. This guy said he started hanging out with people he never would have hung around with as he got worse. And this is somebody that I probably should have looked at and ran the other way. And I didn't. And so anyway, I spent 2 years on the back of a Harley, drinking, going to the bar, get on the bike, get drunk. We wiped out all the time. I was always getting hurt. He was always getting hurt. And this is disgusting, but I'm going to tell you, I used to get sick on the back of the bike because he drove too fast, and I would just turn around and throw up off the back of the bike. One time, I was so drunk that he bungeed me to him because I was nodding off on the back of the bike. And that's how we got back from, where is that, Mobile, Alabama, 2 hours, bungeed. Then my sister came to visit. My youngest sister, was probably the big victim in the childhood thing, because she was the youngest. And when she discovered drugs and alcohol because of her disease, it exacerbated her existing condition, which was bipolar disorder, which we didn't know about. She was also bulimic. She was very sick, but nobody recognized it because everybody was just busy with their own lives. She was one of those geniuses, and she became a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist in New York. But she quickly lost it. She was, I would have to say in the 80s, she was a victim of that society thing where you're supposed to be skinny. And so she discovered cocaine and got really skinny but really lost her mind. And eventually some of the cases that the paper was sending her on, which she went to the TWA Flight 800 out in the Mauritius Bay in Long Island and picking up pieces of body parts, and she just lost it. So she tried to kill herself. And so around that was the time that I was flying around with Jimmy. She came to visit me, and I was the oldest, and my mother said, you know, she wants to come visit you, you take good care of her, make sure she takes her medication. And she saw me, I was very skinny, very, very, very skinny. And she wanted to be skinny like me, and she knew how I was skinny. And so she kept begging me to get her something, and I kept saying, no, I'm not going to get you something, but she was suicidal. And one day she just said to me, if you get me something, I will stop hearing voices and I will feel better. And I loved this girl more than, I might have to say I loved her as much as I love my children. And I can't say that about my other sister, God forgive me. She was just, we were soulmates. And she just kept saying, if you just help me this one time, you know, this is going to change everything. I won't want to die. I won't hear voices. I won't be like a zombie, because she would sit around my house like this. I mean, it was really sad. So I did it for her. And so she and I were hanging out together, drinking. and doing other things, and that night she went to bed and overdosed on all the medication and killed herself. So I woke up and went to work that morning, and when I came home, I found her dead. And you would think, oh, that should stop you from doing things. No. I had to give my kids to their dad, and I. This is actually what happened. We're in what happened. I gave my kids to their dad, and I couldn't stay in the house because it was that's where she had died. And so I moved in with the best person I could move in with, Jimmy and his drunk Harley roommates. And not that Harley's a bad thing. These guys were crazy, crazy, wild, crazy. And so I lived there, and of course I could stay high and not work. And so I didn't stay there that long. I tried to go back and forth, and I tried to go back to work as well. And Jimmy and his friends wouldn't let me get any more stuff to get high because I didn't want to be sober anymore. So I would go drink. I'd wake up in the morning and drink. I'd drink all day. I'd drink at night. Everything I'd get my hands on. One night, I went to the liquor store. After Susie died, I went to this liquor store right near my house, and I went. I bought a big thing of the best vodka, Ketel One. It was my favorite. Vermouth, olives, and little plastic cups, and ice. And I said, "Yeah, I'm having a party." And I went into. I had a van at that time, and I went into the van outside in the parking lot, closed the doors, turned on the radio, and sat in the back of the van. And made martinis and sat there for like an hour and a half drinking and having a party. That was, that, when I look at that now, I think, oh my God, something was really wrong. But at the time, it was so normal. Like, I didn't think anything was wrong with that. Telling people that I was having a party and drinking the whole thing in the back of the van. Anyway. So one day, okay, so I'm going to work every day and thinking nobody knows anything's wrong with me. So one day, I go up to one of the, my little girl, Amelia, I was a preschool teacher in a church. Yes, I was the token Jewish teacher in this church. They loved me. Loved me. And I went up to, I was in the playground, and of course, Jimmy and his friends, nobody would give me anything anymore. So I went up to this mother of this little girl, because I thought I had seen her once smoking pot, and I said, do you know where I can get some blah, blah, blah? The mother of Amelia, my child, my little girl, and she went, oh, no, you know what, I really don't. And the next day was the day that I had a run-in with the Doraville police and almost got arrested. I was at Jimmy's house in Doraville, and I called the police because he was throwing me through the wall, and I kept coming back. And he just kept saying, why don't you just stay down? And I wouldn't, and I kept coming back. And he threw me against the wall, like, a lot. And I said, I'm going to call the police. Instead of staying down and just not coming back at him. So when the police came, of course, I was the one that they wanted to arrest. And I was in a complete blackout. So I don't remember. All I remember is the cop made me sit on the street. And I said, I'm going to make a complaint. And the next day I called in sick to work. And I went to the Doraville police department and said, I want to make a complaint. The policeman last night made me sit on the street. I said, really? I said, yes. And he was rude and he wouldn't arrest them and he wanted to arrest me. And I had bruises everywhere and nobody took my statement. Okay, would you want to write that down? I said, sure. I wrote the whole thing down. It's on my name. And then four policemen come in. They shut the light off and they turn on this video. And it's of me. And I'm standing there, and the cop says in the video, go in your car and sit down, you're going to get hurt. No, I'm sitting on the street, and I'll sit down in the street. And I am swearing at the policeman, and through, you know, trying to hit him and kick him, and I'm looking at this movie going, I don't remember that happening. I don't remember any of that. And they said, I'm sorry, ma'am, we're going to have to arrest you right now because you just signed a false statement. And I said, oh my God, no, I'm a mother and I teach in a church. They didn't arrest me, but they said, we don't really ever want to see your face here again. And I said, okay. But it's funny now. So I went back to work the next day. I had to call a sub that day, plus, well, you don't want to know what made me crazy, but a lot of things. I went back to work, and my boss, the director of the preschool, called me in, and she said, Tammy, you can't work here anymore unless you get help. And I said, help for what? And she said, you have an addiction problem. And I went, no, I don't. Come on, you know, everyone does this. No, you have a problem. And you had it before your sister died, and you're worse now. And you can't work here. We're putting you in the DeKalb Addiction Clinic. And I never would have. I said, oh, sure, I'll go. I'm going because I want my job. That's why I'm going. So I went to this DeKalb Addiction Clinic, and I had to get papers signed, and then they had to report back to the director all the time. So I went to these NA meetings where I just kind of sat there like this. And in the addiction clinic, cool. In the addiction clinic, so I'm in what happened, so that's cool. I'm in the addiction clinic on Wynn Way. It's near my house. And all these people are in the room, and they all say, I'm so-and-so, and I'm an addict, or I'm so-and-so, and I'm an alcoholic. And it's mostly crackheads in there with me, and I'm like, I've never done crack. I just don't belong here. You know, I'm like this, like, cool white teacher, you know, I'm, like, better than everybody. And they actually called me, yeah, they called me a lot of things. Anyway, I'm in there for about a week, and I'm hearing people go, oh, I have 4 days, I'm an addict, and my name's so-and-so, and I have 4 days, or I have this, and I was like, how did you get 4 days? How did you not drink for 4 days? I would like to know how anybody could not drink for 4 days. I really couldn't imagine not even drinking for one day. And so I was like really impressed with these people. And but I still, when it came to be my turn, I would say, my name is Debbie. And I wouldn't say I was anything. The biggest problem I had was walking into that room and seeing those steps. Because I made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. I didn't have God in my life. And it said, Him. I said, I am not going to turn anything over to Him. Nobody named Him. That's how I felt. You know, I was just really, really upset by it. And they kept saying, you don't have to do that right now. I said, I'm not going to get this. I don't believe in a Him. I don't believe in Jesus. I'm Jewish. I'm weird. I'm not religious. I don't know how to pray. How am I going to do this? This is ridiculous. Anyway, it took about 2 weeks. This is my first step, and I'm going to tell you how it happened. There was this girl named Brenda there. She was a crackhead. She was a big girl. She was about 5'11". And I was sitting down. It was my turn, and I was just saying, my name is Debbie, and I'm an alcoholic and an addict. And I said, my name is Debbie. And Brenda got up and walked across the room and picked me up by the back of my shirt. I must have weighed probably 90 pounds then. And she picked me up like this. She said, if she doesn't say it, I'm going to throw her outside. And I'm hanging. So this is a true story. And the woman said, the leader of the group, put her down, put her down. So she said, are you going to say it? And so all the girls, everyone kind of, the woman said, tell her how you feel. Tell Debbie how you all feel. You think you're better than we are. You're worse than we are. Look what you did. Look at you worked in a preschool, and you went out to your car and did stuff during the day while you were working, and they knew everything I had done. And you think you're better than we are, but your sister died right in front of you, and you still did it. Like, you think you didn't hit a bottom. They were going on and on. And that's, I finally went, oh, maybe I have a problem. And I really, honestly didn't. I know a lot of people come in here saying, I knew I had a problem. I didn't. I thought that was normal. That was my whole life. That was normal for me. So I said, my name is Debbie, and I'm an alcoholic. And they were cheering and everything. But that was in April. I relapsed on Memorial Day. Why? Because I rented a... I forgot I bought a Harley. Okay, wait a minute. Let me go back. Okay, Memorial Day. Okay, I'll tell you what happened. Memorial Day, I rented a Winnebago and took my children away camping. Me, my two daughters, one of their friends, and a girl who babysat as a teenager. And it was really fun, and I felt so cool driving this big, huge thing and stopping short, and everyone came flying off the top, and it was kind of fun. So I stayed there for 2 days, and then I came back and took my kids home, and I called Jimmy, and I said, take the Harley. We're going to go back off camping. I won't relapse. I'll be fine. Because at that point, you know that part of it that says, God, half measures, not that half measures, the other one. The result was nil.
Till we let go, absolutely.
Till we let go, something, yeah. So I wouldn't let go of my old playmates, which is what they kept telling me in treatment. And, of course, I'm not letting go of Jimmy. I'm not letting go of that Harley. I had the whole thing. I had the vest with all the buttons. I was at bike week. I had the chaps, the boots, and the jacket, and the helmet. I was cool. I couldn't give it up. So I didn't think I was going to drink, though. But so we have the Winnebago, and we get on the bike, and we're riding. It's beautiful. He goes, hey, do you mind if I stop at Hooters and get a beer? And I said, no, I don't have to drink. That's cool. So the minute I saw the, what's the one with the lime in the top? That was my favorite. Quick. Corona with lime. And I went, oh, just give me a Corona with lime. Yeah. So I had a Corona with lime, and I had another Corona with lime, and I had another Corona with lime, and I had another Corona with lime. And then I was fine. And then I drove the Winnebago back to Atlanta and sideswiped. It wasn't that bad. I sideswiped the gasoline pump. And then I went back and I got my another white chip. This time I got it a triangle. And I said, yeah, but I didn't have any consequences. I really believed I didn't have consequences. So that was my second white chip. And then my third white chip was around the 4th of July. I did the same thing. I went up to Cherokee on the motorcycle and drank. And then one day this brilliant person said to me at Triangle, his name is Richard. I've known him for a long time. He said, Debbie, why don't you go on the Harley with Jimmy and don't drink? And I said, oh. It never occurred to me that I could go on the bike and not drink. But you know what? I didn't want to go on the bike anymore because I really had nothing in common with him anymore, and all I wanted to do was drink, and that was my excuse. So I bought my own Harley. That's a whole other story. But I bought my own Harley. I started going to AA at another clubhouse, and while I was taking the Harley safety test, I wiped out, and the bike that I was using, which was a Buell Blast, went up in the air and landed on my foot. Then I was on crutches, and I never passed the test. But I had this beautiful, brand-new Sportster that I couldn't hold up. Yeah, I used to fall at the heights. So there was this guy at this clubhouse who I didn't know anything about. I was like, oh, look at all these pretty people at Triangle. It's like being in a bar. I could stay sober here. And this guy said, oh, hi, I have 2 weeks. Oh, me too, I have 2 weeks. Can I borrow you? I was like, oh, sure. Anyway, the third time he borrowed it, he sold it for crack. It's gone. The good news is that he told the police that it was carjacked, and so I did get insurance money. But at this point in my life, I think God took it away from me because literally I couldn't hold that bike up. If I tipped over, I had to get help. What was I doing with it? Sportster. They're very heavy. I know you think they're light, but they're not. You know, can you imagine me? I really wanted to be so cool, but it didn't work. All right, so that was my step one. Now what I'm going to do is tell you how I managed to stay sober after that. So my step one was at the treatment center. And my step two believed that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I was so insane. I mean, I don't have to tell you. So I knew I was insane. I had this sponsor who kept telling me I couldn't go out with that guy anymore, stole my Harley. But I kept doing it. And she said, you know, everyone said it to me, I can't sponsor you if you go out with this guy. And you're not supposed to go out with anyone in the first year. You know what, guys, it's not in the big book. So for me, it's not a problem. I kept going out with this guy. And, you know, we were in love. And it was Boy Meets Girl on AA campus. And, you know, we both had 2 weeks, and he stole my Harley button, you know, apologized. Came back later, made amends, you know, gave me a couple $1,000, did some work at my house or something like that. So I had this sponsor who would take me through to my, I got my 90-day chip, and then she fired me because I was supposed to meet her here at some meeting and I didn't make it, and she fired me. I'm sure it had more to do with that I wouldn't break up with this guy. But then I found another sponsor in my fourth month, and I started to do my fourth step, which is what I really needed to do. Because at that point I kept blaming everyone else for my problems. All the guys, they were the problem. They did it. They hurt me. They were drunk. Whatever. My mother, my husband's, whatever. I kept blaming everybody. So the forceps was huge for me. Because by the time I got to the last column, it was all, I was selfish, I was self-seeking, I was very egocentric. I wanted everyone to love me. And it's all over the big book in the 12 and 12 about we get into these twisted relationships and we treat people a certain way and then they retaliate. We step on their toes and then they retaliate. And that's basically what I kept doing. I kept going out with the same person my whole life, just had a different body and face. And so how could I blame them? It was me just picking the same thing over and over again for some reason. So I did my fourth step, and then I did my fifth step with this woman, and it was wonderful because I had to tell her one of the things I really had never told anyone at that point. And this is the first time in a story that I'm telling the truth about my sister. I never put myself in the picture with my sister. I never told the truth. I never said that I was using with her the night before. My mother still thinks that I just found her. So that was the first time I told anybody my involvement, or what I thought was my involvement. I thought I killed her, but I found out later by talking to people that was her 15th suicide attempt. It just was the successful one. So the fifth step was a big deal. It was a big relief. And what kind of ego did I have that I thought I could save her anyway? But I still think maybe if I had gone into AA sooner. My sixth and seventh step, which are mostly all, I do them all the time still, but at that time when I found out all of my character defects, instead of asking God to take them away, I would ask Him for the opposite. I remember every morning saying, God, please give me patience and kindness with my children, because I didn't have a lot of patience in those days. And that helped me. But the sixth and seventh step. Eighth step was making amends, making a list of all the harms. And the ninth step was making the amends. And the hardest one to make was to my mother for everything that I'd ever done. And, I said a lot of things to her, apologized to her for many things. And she said, well, maybe if you had been a better person, your sister would be alive today. And I said, you're probably right. I mean, I thought I was supposed to do something like that. But later on I learned that you're not supposed to allow somebody to, it's in the book, you're not supposed to let somebody make you, I mean, it's one thing for them to say I don't forgive you, but it's another thing for you to be abused. And in retrospect, that was kind of abusive, because I don't think that my behavior caused my sister's death. And I was not her mother. But I didn't say that to my mother. Okay, so my ninth step, my tenth step. My tenth step is something, you know, I have to do all the time. I don't do it diligently like I should, but I end up doing it a lot more when I have more drama in my life, which I don't have right now. The 11th step is the one thing I'm always stuck on. Because I know I'm supposed to every day ask God, like, what's His will for me? And I'm not always really good about the praying and the meditating. However, I've been so calm and different in the past few months, and it's probably because I haven't been in any relationships, and my life has been very quiet, and that has brought me closer to God, believe it or not. And I think in the beginning of my sobriety, even though I was a serial monogamist, you know, I don't just go crazy, but I have relationships. And I sometimes made the other man, a significant other in my life, my higher power. It happened a couple of times, and I've heard of that happening before. And I don't have that now, and it's really nice. I have friends. Something new. The 12th step, I want to do a plug for the 12th step, because when I first got it in the program my first year, I was very active. You know, some people would have said that I was one of those people that wouldn't make it, because I probably should have been one of the people who didn't make it. But I immediately, I think when I had 6 months, I was on the hotline. And I don't know if I told this hotline story. I'm sorry if you've heard it before, but it's such a good story. So I'm on the hotline, and I'm in California. I mean, I'm in Venice, Florida, and I'm on the beach with my kids, and this guy calls me up, and he says, he called the hotline. It was Thanksgiving. I'll try to make it short. And he had woken up in someone's house, and he says, when you're on the hotline, they call the number, and then there's an answering service that sends the message to your number when you're on call. So it's Thanksgiving, and people are drinking and miserable and lonely, and this guy calls me up on Thanksgiving morning, and I'm on the beach. And he says, I just woke up in this house, and I don't know this woman who I woke up with, and I'm a drunk, and I need help. So I tried to call 12-steppers, and nobody would come because it was Thanksgiving. So I said, where are you? He said, Buford Highway. And I was in Venice, Florida, and walked him on the phone to Triangle. Sorry, I guess I could have walked him here. But at the time, that was my home group. So he walked to Triangle. Anyway, blah, blah, blah. 5-6 days later, I come back to Triangle. I'm done with my vacation. I'm on the porch, and Rich is on the porch doing the Christmas tree thing. And I said, Richard, there's too many lights on the tree, or something like that. And this guy turns around, he goes, is your name Debbie? And I said, yes. He goes, were you just in Venice, Florida? I said, yeah. How do you know that? And he says, I'm Roy. His name is Roy, the guy from the hotline. So he was still there, and he stayed there for months. I don't know what happened to him now, but I just wanted to plug service work because those kinds of instances kept me sober. But early on, at 6 months, I did that for a long time. And then I was a... they used to meet every Sunday downstairs. Not the GSI, intergroup, thank you. Intergroup rep, which is you represent your group and you go, those are amazing. I would say anybody who hasn't been an intergroup rep, it's amazing. And I did that for a long time. And you find out what kind of needs there are in AA and how many different people and how many different just meetings and rules and just an amazing thing. It's an amazing thing to be a part of. And you find out about jail meetings, and you find out about what the needs are. Like, if we need someone on the hotline, the intergroup rep goes back and tells everyone at the group, we need people on the hotline. You can send your sponsees. I did that. I did steering committee, which I wasn't able to continue, but that was amazing. There's just all these things, service. Plus, I sponsored people starting at 11 months sober. I had 11 months. And this wonderful person who I'm still sponsoring, and she's got 6 years sober. I have another sponsee who has just gotten her year, but she relapsed several times, but she's been with me for 5 years. And I just got another newcomer, and I have had the same sponsor for 3 years now, maybe four. But I went through a lot of sponsors in the beginning until I found one that wouldn't tell me what to do in relationships, because on page 69 it says we're not the arbiter of each other's sex lives. And I kept saying to the sponsors, want to show me in the big book where it says I can't have a relationship? And they couldn't. But you know, if that, you know, I'm not trying to tread on anybody, you know, do your thing. But, and I shouldn't be an example, because even though I did stay sober, you know, well, I did stay sober. So, I did all the stuff. I do want to say one other thing about my children. My little one has grown up in AA. She was 7 when I came in, and now she just turned 15. And my older one also, they've always been aware of what I was like before and what I'm like now. My older one really knew what I was like before because she was older. Today, my daughter, my 15-year-old, was ordering big giant holes at the gauges that you put in those hideous things that those teenagers have now. You know what I'm talking about? The giant holes. So, Mommy, I want to order some more gauges. So I need your, you know, eBay, PayPal thing. So I'm like, all right, give it to me. You're not looking at my password. She goes, Mom, I never took money from you. I said, that's right. She goes, you took money from your mother when you were drinking. I said, that's right, honey. I did. I said, and you know what else? I also took money from you and your sister when I was drinking. And it just occurred to me because I had forgotten. And I said, I owe you money, I'm sure. She goes, oh, don't worry about it. But we have that open relationship that we can talk about my drinking and how I don't drink anymore, and they just know so much about it that it's not that they're not ever going to do it, but they tell me, "Oh, Mommy, I tried one of those sweet vodka things, Smirnoff something. It's like 3% vodka. They come in these bottles." So her and her friends tried. She goes, "It's disgusting. I don't know how you ever drank." I said, "You know what? Whatever. I don't want to tell them not to do it. I want them to try in front of me for themselves." My other daughter, I smelled marijuana on her with her boyfriend. And I said, "Instead of smoking it in the car, why don't you come in the house or out on the porch so you don't get in trouble?" And they said, "No, that's no fun." Anyway, but right now they're just honest with me. And right now nobody's doing anything. But I do want to show you something. There's a picture in Triangle, a poster up on the wall, and it's a martini drink with an X through it. And when I first went to that clubhouse, I couldn't sit looking at it because I would drool, I'm not exaggerating, drool out of my mouth, drool. Oh, and that took me 3 months of that kind of thinking about drinking and wanting it so badly and praying about it to stop drinking. But my daughter wrote me a card on my third anniversary, and it was that picture of the martini with the cross through it because she remembered me saying that I couldn't look at it. I just have to show you that. Well, she was only eight or nine when she did this. Great job. Love you. Wow. And I wanted to read one thing. Thank you for indulging me. Wow. Cool. All right. This book is called The Best of Bill, and I also love As Bill Sees It, but this time I'm going to read something out of The Best of Bill because it's about humility, and it's one of those things that I feel like I'm never going to attain, but Bill wrote something really good in here about that, because I continue to make mistakes. I'm not perfect. I don't drink, and I sometimes, you know, do the right thing. I try to be a good mother, and I try to be a good person and be of service to people, but I'm definitely not perfect. And I came across this. "We ought to look towards God's perfection as our guide rather than as a goal to be reached at any foreseeable time. I'm sure, for instance, that I ought to seek out the finest definition of humility that is possible for me to envision. This definition doesn't have to be absolutely perfect. I am only asked to try. Suppose I choose one like this. Perfect humility would be a state of complete freedom from myself, freedom from all the claims that my defects of character now lay so heavily upon me. Perfect humility would be a full willingness in all times and places to find and do the will of God." And the only thing I can say is that I always think in my head, is this what God wants me to do? Is this God's will? And if I don't know what God's will is, one person said to me a few years ago, God's will is what is in your best interest, because God loves you and he only wants what's best for you. So if it's in my best interest, then it's God's will. And thanks for listening to us today.
Thank you, Debbie. Now I know why you're so anxious to get up here. Great job. Hey, the seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declaring outside contributions. Your generous donations support this group and AA its own. And we've asked Cecilia to give out the chips.
Hi, Cecilia, I'm an alcoholic. Hey, Cecilia. Thank you, Debbie. Oh, thank you. We have a chip to mark our milestones in sobriety, and we offer a white chip for today, if you want to come in or if you want to come back. Then we have a silver chip for 30 days. Anyone else for 30 days? For 90 days, we have a red chip. For 6 months, we have a yellow chip. For 9 months, we have a green chip. And for 1 year or many years, we have a blue chip. Any birthday? And then we offer the white chip again. Anybody would like to reconsider and leave it up here? And thank God for the 51.
Okay. Any AA related announcements? Anyone like to share? Yes, please.
I'm Brian. I'm Paula Sorrell.
Hey, Brian.
I have a key to literature cabinets, so I'll be there if you need.
Thank you, Brian. Yes, Mark.
My name is Mark. I'm an alcoholic. I also have a key to the literature cabinet if anyone would like to literature see me after the meeting, too.
Okay. Now, I know there's stuff going on. I should have been prepared. There's got to be something.
My name is Henry. I'm an alcoholic. Hey. And I'm leaving this weekend, July 4th. Like they're going to have, you know, hot dogs and cafeteria and stuff open. Sunday, we have Sunday.
And I guess there'll be an exodus by some lucky AAs that are going to San Antonio for the conference, international conference. And we will be having, we'll be the host city 5 years from now. So that's exciting. That's new news to me. I guess some folks knew about it a while back, but I heard about it for the first time a couple of weeks ago at the AA anniversary for AA in Atlanta, the 69th anniversary for Atlanta AA.
My name's Jay. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Jay.
And 35th Atlanta Roundup is happening July 15th through 18th.
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah. Thank you. That's what we need to do. Yes. And I think NAVA is going to have a concession there. I saw something, some email on it, so we'll have some representation there as well.
The cost of the first night is free.
Okay. First night is free?
Yeah, it's $29 registration now, but first night is free.
Okay. Okay, next Monday is the tail end of the July 4th weekend, and we're going to have Larry Kay tell a story. Larry is now recovered from hip surgery, and he has always been one of the hippest NAVA members. So I got a feeling we'll have a big crowd for that. And then following that, Tricia G tells her story on the 12th. So, we continue to bring great sobriety to you here on Monday nights. Any other announcements? Yeah, there you go. I'd like to remind everybody that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities, and for those who will, please join us in a circle for the Lord's Prayer. Okay, Richard. Yes, could you take us up?
All in the silence. If it's offering inside outside the rooms, all about the Lord's Prayer. Please, Father.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, ruler of the evil. For thine is the kingdom, power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Ready, sign? Nope.